Israel, Evidence of God and History by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract, a tour of the history of Israel from ancient times to present, sketching how the biblical prophecies about the nation have been fulfilled. Back in the 1700s, Frederick the Great, a skeptic, once asked his chaplain, "Can you give me any good evidence that God exists?" The chaplain answered, "Yes, the Jews." Well, our talk here, we will attempt to unpack the chaplain's answer. We look first of all at the prophecies, and we start with Moses' blessings and curses, dated perhaps around 1400 B.C. We see the blessings in Leviticus chapter 26. We here sketch a little bit from verses 3 to 13, where God says through Moses, "If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands, I will send you rain in season, and the ground will yield its crops, and the trees the field their fruit. Your threshing will continue until grape harvesting, and the grape harvest will continue until planting, and you eat all the food you want and live in safety in your land. I will grant peace in the land, and you will lie down, and no one will make you afraid." Then we'll get the curses in the same chapter, and whereas the the blessings took up about 11 verses, the curses take up about 33 verses, so about three times as much space. "But if you will not listen to me and carry out all these commands, then I will do this to you. I'll bring upon you sudden terror, wasting diseases and fevers that will destroy your sight and drain away your life. You will plant seed in vain because your enemies will eat it. I will set my face against you so that you will be defeated by your enemies. Those who hate you will rule over you, and you will flee even when no one is pursuing you. If after this you do not listen to me, I will punish you for your sins seven times over." The curses in Deuteronomy 28 also represent a substantially larger section than the blessings in the same passage. And in verses 63 to 68 we get this: "Just as it pleased the Lord to make you prosper and increase in number, so it will please him to ruin and destroy you. You will be uprooted from the land you are entering to possess. Then the Lord will scatter you among all the nations, from one end of the earth to the other. Among the nations you will find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot." Back in Leviticus chapter 26, in the end of the cursing section, we find this remark, verses 40 through 45. "But if they confess their sins, I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and I will remember the land. For the land will be deserted by them and will enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them or abhor them so as to destroy them completely, breaking my covenant with them. But for their sake I will remember the covenant with their ancestors, whom I brought out of Egypt." So, that's a quick sketch of the blessing and curse materials in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. The prophecies in the writing prophets, dating to about 700 B.C., we have this prophecy in Isaiah 11 of Israel to be regathered. "In that day," verse 11, "the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people, from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea." Hosea chapter 3, actually Hosea chapters 1 through 3, gives us a picture of Israel's history in terms of a acted parable in which Hosea is instructed to take as his wife Gomer, an unfaithful woman, perhaps even a professional prostitute. And eventually, Gomer runs off from Hosea after having several children, which we're not sure whether they're Hosea's or not, runs off. And Hosea is instructed to go and bring her back, and that they're to live together but without sexual relations for a good while. And then the explanation given is this, verses 3, 4 and 5 of Hosea 3, "For the Israelites will live many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or idol. Afterwards, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days." Without sacrifice, the sacrifice, of course, had been one of the central features of Israel's relationship with God. Here we see a picture of the altar at the Jerusalem temple without sacred stones. Here the passage has in mind the Canaanite sacred pillars, which picture part of the temptation that the Israelites faced when they came into Canaan of the competing pagan religion there. We can see on these particular pillars, sometimes they're just plain pillars, but sometimes they have other symbols. The one on the right here, a picture of hands reaching up to something looks like perhaps a crescent moon. They'll be without ephod. The ephod was a part of the high priest's garments, and here we see a picture of the artist's conception of the high priest's garments, including the ephod, which was kind of a vest of some sort, shown here in the horizontal stripes. Without idols, the Hebrew word here is actually teraphim, which refers to household idols, and here we have a picture of such a Canaanite household idol. Going on with the prophecies, we have the prophecies made by Jesus about AD 30, and we look at one of these, acceptance and rejection. Now, Jesus has come to the Israelites, and he says in John 5:43, "I've come in my Father's name, and you do not accept me, but if someone else comes in his own name, you will accept him. How can you believe if you accept praise from one another, yet make no effort to obtain the praise that comes from the only God?" Well, let's take a tour of some of the prophecies. We want to take a look at the fulfillments now, and we will give you kind of a tour from about 931 BC up to the present. 931 is a rather crucial date in Israel's history. After 3 centuries as a league of 12 tribes in the territory of Israel, followed by a century as a united kingdom under Saul and then David and then Solomon, the nation splits into two pieces, Israel and Judah, shown here on the map at right. Israel, sometimes called Ephraim or the Northern Kingdom, rejects the rule of David's family and remodels its religion. Judah, the Southern Kingdom, continues with the Davidic kings and the Jerusalem temple and the Levitical priests. There's where Israel was located, and down here where Judah is located on our map. Moving on, after 931, we come to the rise of Assyria to the east, which develops an aggressive empire which reaches the Mediterranean coast. We see here in the green a map of the Assyrian Empire at its height about 700 BC. The Assyrians use great cruelty to terrorize their opponents, and as a result they overrun the nations on the coast in spite of coalitions made against them. This leads eventually to the fall of Israel in 722 BC. Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, is taken, and its survivors are exiled. The picture to the right is an artist's sketch from engraved pictures made nearly contemporary with the events. Since 722 and the destruction of Samaria, only a minority of Israelites have lived in the land since that time. Surprisingly, the southern kingdom survives this same assault, though much reduced. At one point, all of their fortified cities but Jerusalem were taken, and the Assyrians are unable to take Jerusalem, according to Scripture, because of God's miraculous intervention to bring disaster on the Assyrian armies. In 612 BC, the Babylonians take Nineveh and destroy the Assyrian Empire, and as a result, and in its place, they build the Babylonian Empire, which in this map is shown as somewhat larger than the Assyrian Empire, stretching into the desert and down to Egypt and up into Asia Minor, etc. Shortly after destroying the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar reach the Mediterranean coast, and they make Judah, the southern kingdom, a subject kingdom to their empire in 606 BC. Well, following that, Judah rebels against Nebuchadnezzar twice in the years after this, and the second time, Jerusalem is destroyed, 587 BC. The captives are taken to Babylon, and the kingship ends. The temple, built by Solomon nearly 400 years earlier, is leveled. About 50 years later, we have the return from Babylon, 537 BC. Some might wonder, well, I thought the Babylonian captivity was 70 years. Well, yes, it is, measured differently. If measured from the first exiles of the Judahites to Babylon, to the first returns, that's about 70 years. And if you measure from the destruction of the Jerusalem temple to the rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple, that's about 70 years. That's the reason, I think, for the traditional 70-year suggestion there, the date there given in the scripture. The distance from the last destruction, the destruction of Jerusalem, to the first returns is 50 years. When the Babylonian empire is taken by the Persians, 537, the Jews are allowed to return home. However, only a few return. Many had become fairly comfortable by this point, a couple of generations in Babylon, etc. Well, we might ask the question at this point whether the passage in Isaiah 11:11 has been fulfilled yet, the various places from which the Israelites have to return. It doesn't look like it, however. The 537 return is only from a small region, shown here in the right of this picture, not the large area predicted by Isaiah. Nor does it appear that Hosea chapter 3 has been fulfilled yet, as Jeconiah was called king during his captivity, and the priesthood was preserved, even though its functions were interrupted. We move on then, and in the course of time, the Persian Empire is destroyed by Alexander the Great, 332 BC. Alexander swept across Asia Minor, now Turkey, in just a year, destroyed three large armies, and eventually took territory all the way to India before Alexander died at age 33. Here's a map of Alexander's empire, and you can see it takes up enormously more area than the Assyrian and Babylonian empires do, running from Macedonia and Thrace in the northwest down to Egypt in the southwest, across the Turkey and the east coast, the Levantine coast, or the coast of Israel and Syria, and then running down the Tigris-Euphrates valleys, and then all the way across the modern Iraq and Iran and into modern India. Alexander's empire was huge then, although it soon broke into pieces. Alexander treated the Jews well. According to Josephus, this was because they showed him a prophecy about himself from the book of Daniel. After Alexander's early death, his empire was split into pieces by his feuding generals. One of these generals, Seleucus, founds a dynasty that eventually controls Judea. The Seleucid dynasty picked up the area we call Turkey today and north of Israel and running a good ways east, though they lost their eastern possessions after a while. That territory, empire eventually took over Judah. One of Seleucus' descendants, Antiochus IV, considers himself a manifestation of Zeus and tries to destroy Judaism. This takes place around 168 BC. Miraculously, the Jews are able to stop Antiochus and win their freedom under the freedom fighters we call the Maccabees. The Jews, however, are able to keep their freedom for less than a century. Two of the Maccabean descendants fall to fighting over who will rule, and Rome intervenes. This is about 63 BC. The member of the triumvirate named Pompey sides with one of these Maccabean descendants, takes Jerusalem, and the Jews become vassals of Rome. Here we see a map of the Roman Empire, and it's perhaps a little smaller than Alexander's empire, but overlaps only a little bit, and the Roman Empire extends considerably further to the west and has less eastern extension by quite a bit than Alexander's empire. The Romans eventually conquer all the Mediterranean coast, and Judea becomes one of their provinces. The Romans, as pagans worshiping many gods, cannot understand or appreciate the Jewish worship of only one God, and that without images. This leads to a growing tension between them. In 66 AD, as a result, the Jews revolt against Roman oppression. Initially, they are successful. They're able to destroy the Roman forces brought against them initially. But the Romans bring in more legions. The Romans had many legions spread rather thin over the whole empire, and their usual way of dealing with a revolt was to then concentrate these legions in the offending area. The Romans bring in more legions, take the outlying areas, and besiege Jerusalem. And in August of AD 70, the city is taken. This leads to the destruction of the Jewish state. Over 1 million Jews die in the war and the siege of Jerusalem. The rest are sold into slavery, glutting the slave market, as Moses predicted in Deuteronomy 28:68. The final resistance is put down at Masada in AD 73, described by Josephus, and has been dramatized in a television series some years ago. The Romans mint coins to commemorate their victory. Here we see the back of one of these coins with a date palm and the legend Judea Capta, Judea captured, if you like. However, Judaism survives as rabbinic Judaism. The diversity of Judaism this time is thinned down considerably at this point. The Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai was besieged inside Jerusalem and realized that this was a hopeless cause. He pretended to get sick and die, and had his disciples carry his coffin out of the city, and in that way he escapes Jerusalem and surrenders to the Romans. In this picture at the right from comic book of Jewish history, we see Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai saying to Titus, the Roman general, spare the seacoast city of Yavne and its scholars. And Titus says, you might have asked for great riches. Yavne is it? Yavne is yours. Well, Yohanan is given permission to continue his rabbinic school in Jamnia on the coast. Thus, rabbinic Judaism, the Pharisees basically, survives the destruction, but the Sadducees don't. However, only a generation later, in 132 AD, the Romans decide to found a pagan city on the site of the ruins of Jerusalem. A Jew by the name of Simeon ben Kosiba organizes a revolt to oppose this. Rabbi Akiba recognizes Simeon as the Messiah, with the title Bar Kokhba, based on a prophecy in the Book of Numbers. Again, after some initial success, the Jews are defeated by Rome. Bar Kokhba and Akiba are both put to death. Jews are forbidden to come within 10 miles of Jerusalem on pain of death, except on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. And the Holy Land now comes to be increasingly populated by non-Jews. We turn next to the completion of the Mishnah about 200 AD, at which time a written digest of the rabbinic oral tradition is completed. And we see again a frame of this from the illustrated cartoon history of Israel. This is important in preserving rabbinic Judaism, the basis for modern Orthodox Judaism. It also marks an early justification for how Judaism will function without temple and sacrifice. We move next to the rise of Islam In Arabia, Muhammad claimed to be a prophet and gathered followers who spread his message by military evangelism. They take Jerusalem in 638 and hold on to it, except during the Crusades, into the 20th century. Here we see a picture of the Muslim Empire, map of the Muslim Empire. Islam spread rapidly through the Middle East and North Africa, eventually into Europe and the Far East. Sometimes Jews and Christians were killed outright, but usually they were allowed to live as second-class citizens, and as citizens who could not vote and who were charged an extra heavy tax and were discriminated against in a number of other ways. Well, we stop at 1000 AD to review our tour of Jewish history at this point. By this time, the Jews have been without a homeland for almost 1,000 years. Yet they continued to exist as a people, scattered though they were, not being assimilated into the surrounding nations. They had followed false messiahs on at least two occasions during revolts against Rome. Yet they are without king or prince, sacrifice or sacred stone, ephod or idols, since about 70 AD, and with no sign they would return to their land. This brings us to the Crusades. These were wars by Christians to rescue the Holy Land from the Muslims, but they in fact turned out to be a terror for the Jews as much as anything. The Jews tended to be treated as enemies, just like the Muslims. Many Jews were killed in Europe and the Middle East during the 10th through the 12th centuries. In Europe, Jews often faced extortion. Here we see a picture of the Holy Roman Emperor, Rudolf, holding Rabbi Meir for ransom. Meir, however, died in prison rather than let his Jewish friends pay his ransom. Various European nations began to expel the Jews. In England, for instance, King Edward I, in the year 1290, proclaimed that all Jews must leave England. They were not allowed to return until the time of Oliver Cromwell in the 1600s. The same thing happened in Spain after it was retaken from the Muslims. In the year Columbus discovered America, Ferdinand and Isabella forced the Jews out. By this time, 1492, there were few places in Europe for Jews to go. Yet such an expulsion was predicted, Deuteronomy 28, verses 64 through 66. Then the Lord will scatter you among all nations. Among these nations you will find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing, and a despairing heart. You will be in constant suspense, filled with dread both night and day, never sure of your life. Jesus' predictions of false messiahs continued to be fulfilled as well. In 1672, a Jewish fellow named Shabbati Zvi in Turkey claimed to be the Messiah. He attracted a large following. When the authorities jailed him and threatened his life, he became a Muslim. Surprisingly, he still has followers today. Is another example of Jesus' prediction in John chapter 5, verse 43. Jews have generally been treated much better in America than elsewhere, but they've still faced discrimination. This panel from the cartoon book shows their treatment in New Amsterdam, what later became New York. The council made up a list of don'ts. They must build their houses close together. They may not hold office. They may not build synagogues. Until late in the 20th century, Jews frequently faced bias in club memberships, jobs, and housing. I'm going to stop for a review again at 1850 of where things stand in Israel's history. Up to this point, we've seen the disaster prophecies of Moses fulfilled in a striking way. We've also seen a number of people claiming to be the Messiah and attracting a significant following. Israel has also been without king or prince, sacrifice or sacred stone, ephod or idols. But what about Hosea 3:5, that Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and Isaiah 11 regarding a return? return up to 1850. Very little evidence of this fulfillment. But about 1895, a Jewish officer in the French army was court-martialed due to bias. The reporter, Theodor Herzl, Jew, felt that the Jews would never be safe unless they had their own state. You see here the panel from the cartoon book, tortured by what he had witnessed, the Dreyfus Affair. Herzl wrote a book. I call my book The Jewish State. How do you like it? Drop the idea, Theodore. It will lead you to the madhouse. But Herzl founded the movement called Zionism. At one point, Uganda was considered as a place to bring the Jews back to. But later, Herzl became convinced that Palestine was the right place, the historic home of Israel. The settlement in Palestine began in a very modest way. Several wealthy Jews gave funds for Jewish settlement in Palestine. But for a long time, only a few Jews were willing to leave Europe or America for a hard life in the Middle East. As these few settlers returned to Palestine, the question of language arose. What should they speak? Arabic, which was being spoken in the area. Yiddish, what many of them had spoken from their settlement in Europe. And one man, Eliezer ben Yehuda, felt that they would best be united by reviving ancient Hebrew. Here we see him pictured in the cartoon book. The Jewish people will never have a country of its own unless its language is revived. I will revive ancient Hebrew. His dictionary was published in 1909. He became what we might call the Noah Webster of Hebrew. Hebrew was revived. It was modified slightly to mimic certain features of European languages in the way of its tenses worked and such. And, of course, lots of new vocabulary was added for various technological developments. But modern Hebrew was born, and it is a revival of ancient Hebrew and sufficiently similar that one who knows the one can handle the other. This brings us into the 20th century, and we need to think a bit about the Ottoman Empire. By the early 20th century, the Ottoman Empire, which controlled Israel, was in bad shape. It was called the sick man of Europe. It actually only had a little piece of its western part of the empire in Europe. The rest of it was in Asia, if you like. What is today modern Turkey and Syria and Palestine, etc. Well, the Ottoman Empire fell apart at the end of World War I because the empire had been allied with Germany, who lost that war. After World War I, the victors received parts of the Middle East for oversight from the League of Nations. In this map on the right, showing spheres of influence, Britain got the red areas, which would be here Egypt and Palestine and Transjordan and Syria and Iraq. France got the blue parts, which would be Lebanon and Syria. And Italy got the green parts, Libya. Providentially, Britain got Palestine. I say providentially because it so happened that Britain owed a big favor to a Jewish chemist named Chaim Weizmann, who was also a Zionist. Weizmann had invented a substitute for gunpowder called cordite, which allowed Britain to survive the German blockade. The German U-boat blockade had kept them from getting their saltpeter that they needed for the gunpowder, and cordite had allowed them to get by with a type of gunpowder that didn't need that. Well, Weizmann asked that Britain use its mandate in Palestine to provide a Jewish homeland. The upshot was the Balfour Declaration. In 1917, the British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour declared that the government's policy would be to favor the formation of a Jewish state in Palestine, November 2, 1917. Here on the map to the right, we show the British mandate in yellow and orange from 1920 to 1948. the yellow representing Arab settlements and the orange representing Jewish settlements as they stood in 1947. From 1920 to 1948, Great Britain ruled Palestine under a mandate given it by the League of Nations. Well, many Arabs were unhappy with the Jewish settlements and with the British promise. And besides, the British had made promises to the Arabs as well. They had Arab support in defeating the Ottoman Empire in the Palestine area. The upshot of this was Arabs formed guerrilla forces that began terrorist action against Jewish settlers. Jewish response to this? At first, they were unprepared for such attacks. Providentially, however, a British officer in Palestine, Ward Wingate, was a specialist in guerrilla tactics and a believer in Old Testament prophecy. Here again, a cartoon from the pictorial cartoon history of Jewish history. In Palestine, Jewish leaders grew to love Ward Wingate. One of them saying, they say you belong to the Christian group called the Plymouth Brethren. With official approval, Wingate trained the Jews to defend themselves. As a result, they were able to, bring the situation to a stalemate, if you like, but the fighting did not cease. Meanwhile, in Germany, Adolf Hitler came to power in the 30s with a strong anti-Semitic agenda. As the Nazis conquered Europe, they began an ethnic cleansing by killing Jews and some others. This began with firing squads, but soon progressed to gas chambers. One example of this is the Warsaw Ghetto. In Poland, the Jews of Warsaw were forced to move back into the old Jewish ghetto. No Jew was allowed to leave. The Nazis told the Jews that they would be transported to the east for resettlement. Eventually, however, word got back to the ghetto what was really happening, that the resettlement was actually extermination. Many in the ghetto could not believe it. Their view of human nature did not have a category for such behavior. Some of the Jews in the ghetto began an armed resistance. The German military moved in, and after a fierce struggle, destroyed the ghetto. A few young people escaped through the sewers, and there are still, yet at this point, a few people surviving who had escaped from the Warsaw Ghetto. We see, I think, a fulfillment of the Deuteronomy 28, verses 65 to 67 passage. Among those nations you'll find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing and despairing heart. You'll live in constant suspense, filled with dread both night and day, never sure of your life. In the morning you'll say, if only it were evening. And in the evening, if only it were morning. Because the terror that will fill your heart, the sights that your eyes will see. The Jews were very anxious to escape from Europe as Hitler began killing Jews and began his final solution to the Jewish problem. And yet, typically, the Jews found that none of the other nations were willing to take them. And those events eventually led to many of the Jews winding up in Israel. This Holocaust led to a great migration to Palestine. It begins in earnest with the rise of anti-Semitism, 1930s, but is held back significantly by British limitation on immigration into Palestine. The British were not anxious to bring more Jews into Palestine when the Arabs were already very unhappy with the ones that were there, and the British were kind of felt themselves in the middle of a warfare between the Arabs and the Jews. But the immigration becomes very strong just after World War II when the borders open up. With outright war developing between Arab and Jew, the British resign their mandate of Palestine and call on the United Nations, which replaced the League of Nations by now, to draw up a partition. And the map on the right here shows the UN partition plan of 1947, which would produce a Jewish state and an Arab state in Palestine. not very realistic picture of how, you know, what sort of land the state should have to be viable, but that's basically what was done. The Jews accepted this partition, but the Arabs did not. As soon as the British withdraw, the Jews declare the formation of the State of Israel, a Jewish state, for the first time in almost 2,000 years. Thus, on May 14th, 1948, Israel was born. And for the first time in centuries, the Jews now have a prince, according to the prophecy of Hosea chapter 3. The term prince in Hebrew is a term that means government official. It's broader than our English word prince. So we're beginning to see a change in that prophecy there. This leads immediately to what we call the 1948 War. Five Arab armies invade Israel on the day the British withdraw. None of these armies are world-class armies, but they all have many weapons. The Israelis do not. And so the Israelis are faced with the problem that they've got rifles, but the Arab armies have tanks. In spite of this, Israel wins. The Israelis fight back, often with primitive weapons such as Molotov cocktails. They're also able to smuggle in some better weapons. Yet their victory is viewed as almost miraculous, even by many who do not believe in God. Since 1948, Israel has fought several more wars, always on the occasion of Arab provocation. Things have not settled down, but this too is predicted. Zechariah 12, verses 2 and 3, pictures Israel as an insoluble international problem in the years leading up to the second coming of Jesus. The Jews have survived a multitude of disasters and have returned to their land. Well, summary to date. Hosea chapter 3, verse 5 speaks of return and of Israel seeking the Lord their God and David their king. This, I think, seems to be in process from the perspective of Christianity. There are more Jews accepting Jesus as their Savior in the last part of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century than in the whole period of time back to the first century A.D. So something there seems to be in process. Isaiah 11 speaks of a second regathering, and this too seems to be in process. The Bible predicts continual problems for the Jews in their lands until the Messiah returns, and this at least seems to be satisfied currently. Regarding the exile and return of Isaiah 11, the places named in Isaiah 11 correspond to Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Syria. The coastlands of the sea correspond to North Africa and Europe. If we actually make a chart of return of the Jews, the Holocaust removed many European Jews, many of whom went to Israel. Since the time of World War II, anti-Jewish feeling in Arab countries has caused most Jews to leave also, many to Israel. Here we see a chart on the right of the Jewish populations in Egypt, Iraq, Iran, and Syria. And you see that all of those have come down very substantially in the years since the end of World War II. The statistics here are only up through 83. And the number in Iran has dropped off even further since the coming of Khomeini, which runs beyond where the statistics in this chart go. Well, that's a tour of Israel's history and its evidence of God in history. It has something bearing on solutions to our own problems. Many today are worried whether the human race will make it. Some seek guidance from the occults. Others look for extraterrestrial intelligences who have solved the kind of problems we have. What we really need to do, rather than seeking the occult or extraterrestrials, is to seek God. We We've looked at how what God said about Israel has come true in detail. This is just a part of the evidence. We have other parts of it in other of our PowerPoint talks here on the IBRI website. But this evidence shows us that God has the whole world in His hands. For further reading, we recommend a book that we've edited, The Evidence of Prophecy, a group of articles by myself and some of my students, plus some classical articles done in the 19th and 20th centuries. Want evidence from the events in the surrounding nations around Israel, from events in Israel, and from events related to the Messiah, where we see that the Old Testament prophecy has been fulfilled in detail.